Now, some of you are still, you know, at some level paralyzed by this, and there's this sense of shock. I see people like this. Usually, I mean, does anyone have like hand sanitizer out already and doing, yeah, in the back? It's like, shh, it's going to get passed up and down the rows. Let me ask you a couple of questions. What is more awkward for you? Is it more awkward for you to touch someone else's feet or to have someone touch you? How many of you would say it was more awkward for me to touch someone else's foot? Or how many of you would say it's more awkward to have someone touch yours? Okay. Yeah, for some of you, it's like, that's the grossest thing I've ever done in my life.
I know.
All right, so what's the point? There is a point. Okay. So you're going, really? What I want you to do is I want you to get a sense of what happened the night that Christ died. And I don't want you just to read it in the context of John 13. I want you to feel it. I want it to be tangible for you. And you just touched 5. Right? Christ did 12 pairs. He didn't just touch them and jump away and go, oh, gross, that's the grossest thing I've ever done in my life. Okay, what Christ did is he got on his knees, girded himself with a towel, he took a basin of water, and he knelt down and he picked up each one of those feet. And just as we read with what this prostitute did for Christ, which sometimes when we read her taking her hair and washing the feet of Christ, that kind of gives us the heebie-jeebies sometimes. We're not real sure what to do with that in our Western perspective. Right? In an Eastern context, that makes perfect sense as an evidence, even as Keith said, of love for him. And what Christ did is he took those feet, he took that basin of water, and he didn't go quickly, he took his time, and he washed every single one of them. All right, that's John 13, and that's where I want us to go. What I want to focus on in John 13 is we're going to describe the event, but beyond describing the event, I want us actually to focus not on the foot washing element of it. All right, we know the element of the foot washing. What I want to focus on is actually the first 3 verses of John 13. All right, let's just get the scene. Let's set the narrative so we have the framework for it. Obviously, this is the night of the Passover. This is the night that Christ is going to be betrayed. Judas is going to lay the betrayer's kiss on. At that point in time, the disciples will flee other than John. John being young enough, and we'll get there in a moment, actually goes into the trial setting with Christ. But the rest of them are gone at this point. Christ is communicating, as we know, in really John 13 going through John 17, his last message to the disciples on this side of glorification. So he's communicating that which he wants them to grasp, he wants them to understand, and ultimately what he's going to say in John 13 is what you have seen, I want you to practice. Now, I'm just going to lay this out now. For sake of time, I'm not going to develop it. You can trust me, or better than that, just do your own study. Right, when Christ says, what you have seen me do, okay, you should do also. He's not talking about just the outward evidencing of foot washing. Okay, that's not what he's talking about, and we know that. Because when he talks to Peter, we know that Peter says, hey, you know, you're not going to wash my feet. And Christ responds by saying this, what I'm doing to you, you don't understand now, but you will afterwards. Okay, what that's a clue for us to grasp is that the foot washing was not merely about foot washing, or Peter would have gotten it. Right? The afterwards that Christ is speaking about there is the after the crucifixion and resurrection. And so Christ himself says, what you're watching right now, you're not grasping until post-resurrection. Because I think the whole concept of the foot washing was really Christ manifesting to the disciples the reality of not just being a servant, but of the one going to the cross and living a crucified life. And I think the foot washing is merely an example of this crucified life. that Christ ultimately is going to manifest for them in reality in the hours to come. Disciples are gathered together. They go into the upper room. As they go into the upper room, you know the story, they all get to the round table. In ancient Near Eastern, round table, small, probably 18 inches off the floor. Okay? They're not sitting in chairs like you are. They're laying down at the table like this. Right? Leaning on one elbow reaching out so they can grasp the food. So the picture you have is really the table would be the hub of the wheel. And then the disciples would all be like spokes going outside of the hub. The Gospel of Mark actually tells us what the disciples are talking about as they're going into the upper room. And what were they talking about? You remember? Who's going to be greatest in the kingdom? So all the disciples are flooding into the room. They're about ready to celebrate the Passover. In their mind, all they hear is the echoes of Hosanna, King of the Jews, from the triumphal entry. And now Christ sitting at the table with them, and they're having this discussion about who's going to be greatest. And Christ sits at that table. As he sits at that table, he watches those disciples. And then in verse 4, it says, we're just going to cut to the action. It says, he arose at that point from supper, lays aside his outer garment, takes a towel, tied it around his waist, then he poured the water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that he was wrapped with. So Christ rises up, goes to the door, takes his outer garment out, puts the towel around him, takes the basin of water, starts at the first disciple, and we don't know the order of the disciples, but starts at the first disciples and begins to wash their feet. And in the back of my mind, my curiosity immediately asks the question of, I wonder how long it took for that room to grow silent. Was it the first disciple that they really realized what was going on? Or was it the second, or was it the third, or was it the fourth? And that's just a question that it's in my mind every time I read this passage. Second question that comes to my mind is, I wonder if there was eye contact between Christ and Judas Iscariot. Because in verse 2, we're told that the devil, having already put in the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. So Simon had already sold out. So as Christ is washing the disciples' feet, I can't help but wonder, does Judas have the courage to turn and to look at Christ when this is happening? Or would he just look away the entire time? I think obviously we know what happens when he gets to Peter. Sometimes we think of this as a bunch of old men sitting around the table. Okay? Let me just, I'll make another argument for you, that Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper is not accurate. Obviously, they're sitting at a table instead of down at the table. The second thing that's not accurate, I would suggest, is the age of the disciples. Sometimes we have an idea that all the disciples were like, you know, 35 and 40-year-old fishermen. I'm just going to make a suggestion to you that most of the disciples were probably age 25 and below. And that a number of them were probably late teenagers. I think there's reasons to believe that. I think John clearly probably followed Christ when he was 13, 14 years old. That's why he could actually go into the trial and no one held him accountable. He could stand at the foot of the cross, no one held him accountable because he was just a kid. He hadn't even come of age yet. So you didn't see the Jews seeking after John. Third thing I'd say as far as John is concerned is that's why he lived so long also. And he's writing the book of the Revelation in AD 90. Right, why? Because he's probably 13, 14, 15. Probably started his Jewish apprenticeship of following Christ right after what we would define as his bar mitzvah. Probably a 13, 14-year-old. And typically, a late teenager would be given an apprentice or a master, and they would follow that master for a period of years. Another interesting thing you actually see in Luke is you see the mothers of the disciples actually following the disciples. Why? Well, because that would be their task. That's their responsibility. They're taking care of their sons. There's probably two disciples that are older than age 20. One we know is older than age 20. Because again, we're told in Luke that the Pharisees come and they ask Christ, and they ask Peter, and they say, Peter, why aren't you and the master paying the temple tithe? So Peter goes to Christ and says, why aren't we paying the temple tithe? And Christ says, go down, catch a fish, pull out two coins, and go pay the temple tithe. And so that's what they do. So the question is, why did the Pharisees only say Peter and Christ? Well, the temple tithe was only required for those that are age 20 and older. If you're younger than 20, you didn't have to pay the temple tithe. So this is probably a non-issue for everyone else that wasn't there. I think probably Peter was older than 20. As a matter of fact, I know Peter was older than 20. And I would suggest probably Matthew was older than 20. But the rest of them are probably late teens, early 20s. Now, can you imagine Christ sitting at the table and looking at a group of a youth group? That's the scene. I want you to visualize the scene. There's the table. There's the disciples. Feet pointed out. The discussion is who's going to be greatest in the kingdom. Christ rises up. And one by one, he washes their feet. Now the question is simply this. What motivated Christ to do this? What was Christ thinking? And interestingly enough, we're told exactly what Christ was thinking. Sometimes in the Gospels, you get these incredible divine narratives where instead of just the eyewitness speaking to the outside of what's happening, the Holy Spirit, through divine inspiration, gives John an inside look at what Christ was thinking. It's actually found in the first three verses. In the first three verses, there's three phrases. In the way our English Bible is structured, we don't necessarily see them completely this way, but they're in complete parallel. It's Jesus was thinking, or Jesus was doing, and there's three participial statements that are just doom, boom, boom. So we know exactly what Christ was thinking. All right. That's what I want us to focus on in our final session. We've talked about the past, how to deal with the regrets. We've talked about, Lord willing, the future, how to invest your life. But what do we do now? Right now. What does Christ want us to be right now? And I'll simply say what Christ wants us to be right now is a model of what he was in John 13. And it's not just about being a servant that gets their towel dirty by washing other people's feet. Being a servant doesn't start, again, with behavior. Being a servant starts with what? It starts with your beliefs. Beliefs impact behavior. So the question is, what was Christ believing that led him to the behavior of a servant? Now let's read the first three verses. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to his Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, that he was come from God and was going back to God, now the actions begin. Verse 4, which we've already read, he rises. Now, in verse 1 and 2, we have two statements that give us an understanding of what Christ was thinking. And then in verse 3, we have a third statement that gives us an understanding of what Christ was thinking. So let's just walk through those. How do we develop the mindset of a servant, the attitude of a servant? What does it look like? All right, very first one. Says this, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of the Father, or to depart out of this world to the Father. The very first thing. All right, so what does that communicate to us? Christ is sitting at the table, and as he's sitting at the table, listening to the disciples, in his mind, he is thinking this, my hour has come that I'm going to depart to the Father. That's a motivating factor that's going to prompt him to rise up and begin to wash the disciples' feet. So in what way does that statement provide a motivating factor for Christ? He knew that the hour had come where he was going to go to his Father. I'll simply suggest that that's this, that the attitude of a servant is one of an eternal perspective. It's an eternal perspective. Christ knew that his time was limited. The hour had come, which is a theme all throughout the Gospel of John that we don't have time to develop. But it is his time to go. So he's sitting there, and in the back of his mind, he's thinking to himself, I have X number of minutes to pour my life into these men that are sitting around this table. And if I don't seize the moment, I'll lose it. Now, the reality is this. Every single one of us makes decisions today based upon what we're going to do tomorrow. You did that last night. Some of you, as a habit of life, how many of you, as a habit of life, usually go to bed before 10 o'clock? All right, a couple of you. How many before 10:30? How many before 11? How many before 11:30? How many of you normally stay up past midnight? Okay, handful of you. How many of you last night stayed up past midnight? All right, what changed your behavior?
Friends. Yeah, and what changed your behavior was the schedule.
The schedule says fellowship time, 9 to midnight. Right? But that had part to do with it, but really what had more to do with it was the recognition that you knew what today was going to hold. And you went, hey, I can do anything I want tonight. I can eat, I can have fellowship, I can play games, because the next day I'm going to sleep in a little bit and it's kind of a relaxing day. And so what you knew about today impacted your response last night. Okay, it's just the natural way things are. When I was a youth pastor, I spent a lot of time with the guys in the youth group. I was single at the time. And so I focused on the guys. And I had a group of junior high girls, or about 13 of them, that started to complain. They said, you know, Pastor Brian never spends any time with us. And I was like, yes. And so I made a decision of youth. I said, why don't you guys plan an activity and I'll come? And so they all got together. And then their parents got together, and they said, we got a 3-activity plan. It's going to be on a Friday night. I said, great, what are we going to do? And they said, we're going to watch 13 hours of Anne of Green Gables. So, we had an all-nighter. Okay, me, 13 junior high girls, and 13 hours of Anne of Green Gables. Okay, and some of you go, I didn't know it was that long. We watched it more than once. Okay, even though they all had it memorized. And then with that, the parents provided food, and they set me up. Have you ever heard of Jolt Cola before? They used to make Jolt Cola. Twice the caffeine, twice the sugar. Okay, I'm talking, they had more sugar. And so you put 13 junior high girls on a sugar high with Anne of Green Gables. I just sat there for 13 hours and laughed. Not with them, primarily at them. But it was absolutely hilarious. And then the morning, they didn't go to bed. I made omelets for them, made a breakfast for them, gave them their omelets, and their parents came and picked them up around 9:30 or so. What did those girls do the minute they got in their cars?
Sleep.
Man, they were gone. Like one girl actually slept all day Saturday, all Saturday night. They had to wake her up on Sunday to get to church. And the parents were like, what did you do to them? I was like, nothing. Right, why did those girls stay up all night? But they stayed up all night because they knew they could sleep all day on Saturday. We all make the decisions today based upon what we know about tomorrow. This is exactly what Christ did. Christ made a decision this night because he knew what was coming tomorrow. And what was coming tomorrow was this. He was going to his Father. And because of the recognition that he knew he was going to his Father, it absolutely spurred him into action at that moment. If you are going to be a servant now, model Christ, live the crucified life, it starts with an internal spirit-led time clock that says, my time is limited. Right, we all know the CT says statement, only one life will soon be passed, only what's done for Christ will last. But do we recognize how quickly that time goes? Do we get it? Again, I'm not going to speak of age and death, because many of you don't even think in terms of that. I've been forced to recently. I've been forced to because my father right now is on day 71 in the hospital. 71. 5:30 this morning, they put him on a ventilator. All right? Which, for those that don't know, that's the final stages. I've gone to his home the last 3 weekends, because every time I travel, I realize I've got to say goodbye now. Because I might not be back. And I texted my sister this afternoon, and I said, if I need to cancel and come home, I will. And she said, don't worry about it. You already said goodbye. That quick. Christ knew what tomorrow was. He made decisions today based upon tomorrow. That's the first dominating thought of an individual who lives a Christ-centered, crucifix-oriented, heart-filled servant life, if I can phrase it that way. All right, there's the second
phrase that's there. The second phrase is simply this. It says this, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. I love that little phrase there. He loved them into the end.
There's actually two ways of potentially interpreting that. All right, number one is he loved them until the end of the time that he was with them. So it speaks about a love as it relates to quantity. The second way is to see it as he loved them to the uttermost. And that speaks in terms of a love in terms of quality. So the question is this. In what way did Christ love his disciples? Did he love them in terms of to the end of time, or did he love them into the end of quality? And the answer is what? Both. All right, so any way you want to take this. The reality is that if we are going to live this kind of a servant-oriented life, what we have to do is we have to have a God-centered, spirit-prompted love for others. Even those that are incredibly unlovely. And this is where I go back to the picture, and I don't want you to miss the picture here. And this is why I think right after this phrase that the Holy Spirit inserts verse 2, where it says, Judas, Simon's son, already had in his heart, the devil having already put in his heart the spirit to betray him. Christ loved the unlovely. So Christ is sitting there, he's looking at the disciples, and he hears them talking about who's going to be greatest. And if I were Christ at that moment, I know exactly what I would do. I would have said, guys, will you just be quiet for a moment? Do you not realize that you've been with me for 3 years? Do you not realize that what's going to happen tonight? Are you that clueless? Can you just give me a quiet moment of meditation with my Father before I get betrayed and before I go to the cross? Guys, hush. That's what I would have done. What Christ does, he gets up and he takes his outer garment off and he gets a basin and he starts to wash the feet of these guys. That's love. That's love. And by the way, the washing of the feet is no small thing as far as the ancient Near Eastern society is concerned. Just years before Christ does this, there's actually a lawsuit that's recorded in the Jewish annals. And the question is simply this. A rabbi comes home, and when a very famous rabbi comes home, and when he comes home, his mother sits down and begins to wash his feet. And the rabbi says, no. Mother, you're not allowed to wash my feet. That's below you by way of a position. And the mother says, I deserve the right to wash the feet of my son, who's this well-known rabbi. And they actually took it to court. Who has the right to wash feet? And the Jewish court cited in favor of the rabbi, saying that no Jewish woman should wash the feet of a Jewish male. That the washing of the feet is for a lower level of society. That's why what Christ is doing is shocking to the disciples and really shocking to the first century readers. It's an evidence of complete and total love. Can I just ask this? How do you love people? Now, there's two different ways of looking at that question. One, your answer to that could be, well, this is the way that I love people. By way of behavior. That's really not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is this. How do you love people? What is it within you that prompts the spirit of love? That when you see others, you are motivated to serve them regardless of their position. I'll simply say that where Christ started as far as his love was concerned is he saw people clearly. Just for a moment, go with me to Luke chapter 4. In Luke chapter 4, there's this great scene when Christ initiates his ministry where he actually quotes a portion out of Isaiah 61. In Isaiah 61, and I'm just going to cut right to the chase in verse 18, says this, and he's reading Isaiah 61 verse 1. He says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those that are oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And he rolled up the scroll, gave it to the attendant, sat down, and all the eyes of the synagogue were fixed on him, and began to say unto them, today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Right? What Christ is doing is he's using Isaiah 61 as a messianic text to define his ministry to people. But I want you to see how Christ saw people here. The last word in those phrases describes how Christ saw people. He saw them, number one, as poor. Number two, as captives. Number three, as blind. Number four, as oppressed. When Christ saw people, when we see people, we have a tendency to see them in very tangible ways. We see them based upon the color of their skin. We see them based upon what we perceive to be their economic status. We see them based upon their age. We see externals. What Christ does is Christ gets right beyond all the externals and gets right to the heart. And he says, the way that I see people is, one, poor, spiritually bankrupt, spiritually impoverished, unable to satisfy their own souls. Two, I see them as captives. I see them as bound to their sin. Three, I see them as blind. They're spiritually without sight. And then finally, four, I see them as oppressed. They need to go. They told me they were leaving. Okay. I see them as oppressed. When Christ sees people, what he sees is not the externals, he sees the heart. And when he sees the heart, that motivates him to love. Again, we live in a really, really, really sterile society. And what I mean by that is, you go down the streets of any major city in America, and rarely do you see a leper on the streets. Occasionally, you might see a panhandler, someone holding a sign saying, give me money because I'm a vet. But rarely do you see a real beggar that's out there. When we see blind people, we see them in sterilized settings. They have their glasses on. They have their white canes, their red tips. They make their way through. And they're actually pretty mobile within our culture. But just hypothetically, let's say that a blind individual were to walk in that door right now, stumble his way to the door, and start walking in. And as he was walking in, you know, he'd be bumbling and stumbling and making his way to the chairs. What would every single one of you do? Every single one of you would rise to your feet, and you would walk over, and you put your arm around him, and you say, you know, how can I help you? Let me get you seated. Right? You would do that just because of the natural compassion of your heart. Right? That is human love. Right? What Christ is doing is, when he sees people, what's prompting him to love people is he's getting right into their inside, and he's saying, they are spiritually bankrupt, they're poor. They're morally bound. They're captives. They're intellectually blind. And they're totally oppressed. The little word oppressed there actually speaks of a clay pot that's been shattered with an iron maul. They're eternally doomed at that point. When we see people the way that Christ sees people, we will love people the way that Christ loved people. What is it that prompts him to get up from that table and to wash the disciples' feet? Number one is he has an eternal perspective. Number two is he has a God-given love or passion for people. He rises. There's a third reason. Go back with me to John 13. And the third reason is actually just found in verse 3 and says this: Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, that he was come from God and was going back to God. So, Christ is thinking first about the time frame. He's going to go to his Father. Second, he's thinking about his love for them. Third, he's thinking about the reality that God had given all things into his hands. Ask a simple question here. Does Christ lack anything? Absolutely nothing. Right. Hypothetical. If you were, by chance, to win the Powerball lottery, I won't ask you how many of you play it. I trust none of you, but let's hypothetically say that someone in your family gave you a birthday gift, and it was a Powerball, a lottery ticket, and you won, well, we'll give it a nice round number here, $100 million. Right, question, what would you do with it?
Right,
some savings. What would you do with it?
Pay taxes.
All right. 65% of it is now gone, but you still have $35 million. Not bad. All right. What else would you do with it?
Go back to college.
College. I pay loans. Might buy a car. Might buy a house. Might buy my parents a house. They would appreciate that. Do you know how much money that is? Do you realize that if you invested even at a minimal level, the interest itself would be hard to spend on a daily basis? I mean, that's an incredible amount. You know how fun it would be to be able to walk down the streets and have a Christian brother come up to you and say, I mean, I've got a college bill that I've had a hard time paying. Could you help? You say, well, how much is it? And they say, it's $8,000. And you think to yourself, in the time that I've had this conversation, I just made $8,000. Sure, not a problem. 8K, I can do that. 20K for a missionary? Easy. Sending someone to China? I won't send them to China. I mean, I'm going to send their entire family to China, plus I'm going to buy them a house when they get there. I mean, you know how fun it would be to give that away? Because the reality is this. When you know that you have everything, it means nothing to give something. I'll say it again. When you know that you have everything, it means nothing to give something. This is exactly the perspective that Christ has. Christ says this. He says, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. Christ looks at his situation as he's sitting at the table and he says, I have everything. The Father has given me everything. So, when I have everything, it means little for me to give something. Christ wasn't about getting. He already had everything. Now he had the opportunity to give. And what he gives is an act of service as a reminder to the disciples of what a disciple-oriented, Christ-oriented, cross-oriented life would look like. All right, now how does that play out in our world? Let me just ask a simple question here. What do you lack? What do you lack? Now, most of you, even by asking the question within this context, very few of you, at least I hope none of you, are going, well, I lack a nice car. I lack a little bit of money. Now, most of you are sitting there going, I lack nothing. Because in reality, in Christ, you have everything. You have need of nothing. So I'll simply say this. When you have everything, it means nothing to give something. What is the attitude of a servant? The attitude of a servant starts not with the action, it starts with belief. It's the belief that the clock is ticking and they live in light of eternity. They have an eternal perspective. Number two, they measure their life in terms of their internal passion and their love for others. Because they love, they serve. And that love doesn't come from some level of self-motivated compassion. It comes from seeing people as Christ sees people. And then number three, the attitude of a servant realizes that they have everything. They have everything. See, sometimes we view a servant as one who has nothing. Christ views a servant as one who has everything. So for them to serve, it means nothing. They serve because they can. They serve joyfully. They serve willingly. And at the end of the day, what matters is how dirty their towel is. That's what matters. When Sherry and I first got married, or actually before we got married, we did our premarital counseling with someone, and I walked into their office. And in their office, there was a cross stitch. And the cross stitch was of a basin and of a little pot of water and of a towel. And the question that was embroidered on that cross stitch was simply this, how dirty is your towel? And I walked over and I looked at it, and this was before even Sherry walked into the room, and the individual who was doing our premarital counseling walked over to me, and I asked him about it, and he said, well, my wife made that for him. He said, that's the question I ask myself every single day. And he looked at me and he said, Brian, that's the question you need to ask yourself as it relates to your coming marriage with Sherry. Every single day, how are you going to dirty your towel as the leader of your home, as it relates to your wife? That's a challenging question. But the reality is it's not challenging only within the sphere of my relationship with my wife. It's challenging in the sphere of my relationship with everyone. Because what Christ does is he asks us the question of how dirty is our towel, and he doesn't limit that to our closest and dearest relationships. He extends it beyond those relationships to those that are even enemies, Judas Iscariot. What should we be doing today? we should be getting our towels dirty.
In your home, how dirty is your towel?
I'll just throw this out, side issue, very quickly. Some of you still live with your parents. You know, homes are really made for two adults, just generally speaking. More than that, get a little uncomfortable sometimes. You know what keeps a home with more than two adults at an equal status, meaning at an even status, at a balanced status? What keeps it that way is when all the adults start serving one another. When all the adults start serving one another, then you know what? You can have multiple adults in a room, in a house, because they're serving one another. And when they're serving one another, it works. You be the adult. You be the servant. So, how dirty is your towel in your family relationships? How dirty is your towel in your church relationships? How dirty is your towel in your vocational relationships? You say, man, in my work, if I acted like a servant, I would get run over by like a truck. No. You're Christ-like. You don't have the same philosophy of life as the world does that says, I have to get ahead. I have to be in front. No, you get your towel dirty there, and you let Christ do the rest. How dirty is your towel in your neighborhood? Because ultimately, when you stand before God, His question is going to be, if I can use the metaphor, how dirty was your towel in life? This is what Christ did. It's what He calls us to do. It starts thinking right. Verses 1, 2, and 3. Hopefully that will be our goal and our encouragement. Because I will say this. It doesn't take brains to get your towel dirty. It doesn't take money to get your towel dirty. It doesn't take good looks to get your towel dirty. It takes a servant's heart to get your towel dirty. And we can all do that. Let's pray. Father, thanks for your goodness. Thanks for modeling for us what our life ought to be like in you. And Lord, I'm thankful that even as we go through this, there's an implied reality that we cannot do this in our own strength. So I would ask that you would empower us to think like you thought and open our eyes so that we can serve others. And by doing so, may they see little Christ in all of us, because we're not greater than our Master. We'll give you thanks in your name.